Man, I always pick those videos because it's amazing how that guy draws so well, so fast. Right? I can't even draw well slow. Right? I can't even draw well slow. And then, not only was that guy drawing so fast and so well that he was talking all at the same time, that just blows my mind. That guy, his ability to multitask, just crazy. And then I step back for a minute and think, maybe he drew that at normal speed and then speeded it up on the video. And then maybe he or somebody else talked over it. Then I start to feel better about myself. And then I try to draw. And I feel bad all over again. I don't know if you guys know, but I really wish I could draw. I don't know if you can hear that in my tone and my words. So if any of you have a magic formula to help me learn how to draw, it's not part of the sermon, that's just kind of me asking for help. We are in a series called Simon Says, and we're just studying through the book of 1 Peter, and if you think, oh man, how long have you been doing it? This is our third week. Third week, I probably missed so much. Well, good news is we've only made it through 5 verses, and today we'll only make it through 4 more, so in our third week, we're going to get through 9 whole verses, which will get us halfway through chapter 1. By the end of today. The imagery that we were going with the Simon Says is, I don't know how many of you remember that game, Simon, a little circle, it's got the lights light up, kind of similar to the picture that you see, and one light would light up, and blue, and blue-red, and blue-red-green, and blue-red-green-blue. You have to follow the pattern. What we saw as we were reading through the book of 1 Peter was there were some very specific things that Peter was saying that built on each other. So we came up with this phrase. I actually stole this phrase from one of my childhood heroes. But check this out. We want to be people who live as the people of God, who accomplish the mission of God with the suffering love of God shown to us in the gospel of God. So that video, what it was talking about is how we see our lives through the lens of the cross. Well, what other lens could I see my life through? We'll talk about some of that today, but we really want to leave here today with this understanding that if we look at life through the cross, if we look at life through the gospel, then we can really start to understand who we are as the people of God, and then we can learn to live as the people of God, and that's what the next great thing say. So, flip in your Bibles to 1 Peter chapter 1. If you're new to this whole church, God, Bible thing, there's a table of contents in the front. It'll tell you exactly what page number to flip to. And we will be in verse 6. I'll give you guys a minute to get there. I'm going to slow down and breathe. Think about how awful I am at drawing. Wish I could draw better. By then, hopefully you've got it. If not, they'll be on the screen for you. Here we go. 1 Peter chapter 1, starting in verse 6, it says, "In this you rejoice, though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been grieved by various trials, so that the tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Though you have not seen him, you love him, and though you do not now see him, you believe in him, and you rejoice with joy that is inexpressible and filled with glory, obtaining the outcome of your faith, the salvation of your souls." If you're new with this, what I usually do is I just kind of let each verse build on itself. But today I think that there's something very important in the middle that we need to jump to so that we can establish our standard, and then we'll go back and see how everything builds on that idea. And it's in the middle of verse 7 where it talks about how your faith, the tested genuineness of your faith, it's more precious than gold. Even though that gold is refined and it's beautiful, that gold's going to burn up one day. So the tested genuineness of your faith would be more precious than gold. So I just thought, you know, how many times, I see this a lot, but how many times does the Bible talk about gold? And it talks about it. It mentions gold 365 verses in the Bible. That's one for every day of the year mention gold. And a little bit more than half of them compare gold to your faith. It means a little bit less than half are about money or about things made out of gold. But a little bit more than half of the time, stands in comparison and sort of contrast to your faith. Gold, when you dig it up, how many of you like the show? It's on A&E called, what is it called? No, it's the Gold Rush. That's the one. These guys are just up in Alaska digging for gold, and they can only dig for so long. And so they dig it out, and they're like, they see it, it flows through, and they look at it, and there it is, there's the gold. And you're looking at it like, that's just rocks. Those are just rocks. But they know what the gold is, and so they take the gold, they melt it all together. And the process of melting gold and making it pure it goes through a fire, it goes to liquid, and then all of the impurities rise to the top. The impurities are scooped out. It's a continual process until the point where none of that is rising to the top anymore. And that stuff that rises to the top is called dross. And the reason that the Bible equates your faith with gold is because there's a big Bible word called sanctification. That's a big Bible word. And what that word means is, it's the process that God uses to make you look more like Jesus every day. So sometimes he turns up the fire in your life so that the impurities rise to the top and they can be scooped out. That's okay. Now I understand a little bit more about what the Bible says about gold. So I started reading about gold just in general. And got some ideas and some thoughts. And one of them came in terms of the Great Depression. The Great Depression happened in the 30s, and the stock market crashed in 1929. And then through the beginning of the 1930s, what was called the most difficult financial time in American history, they started wondering, do we back our gold? Because to this point, people, in human history, they had gone where I give you two chickens and a thing of orange juice, and now you give me 2 gallons of milk, and we call that even, that's fair, I gave you a good, and you gave more, I come out and I help you plow your field, and now you give me a sack of flour, and now we're friends. Then people started trading paper. Paper is now what we use, and so paper was backed by gold. There was gold in the bank, and the paper represented gold, which is kind of weird. 1 ounce of gold equaled like $1.67. However, they came up with that. Same process for sterling. If you've ever heard the European phrase 1 pound sterling, that was that note was supposed to be worth 1 pound of sterling silver. Precious, perfect silver that had been refined. So then these geniuses that reside in the office of the government decided, maybe we don't need to back the paper with any gold. Maybe we can just let the paper stand for itself, and so it can be on the honor and integrity of the person who gives it, and the honor and integrity of the government to back it up. So through this process, the dollar starts to become less. I know this seems like a weird history lesson, and I don't understand how it applies to the Bible, but we'll get there, I promise. So the dollar starts to not be worth anything, and so what they came up with, how many of you ever heard of the phrase the gold standard? Gold standard, which means that $1 has to be represented by 40% gold in the bank, which means there's 60% of that which is credit, 60% of that which is trust, but 40%. And so there was this guy who thought, and that's weird, and so he wrote a satire about how crazy an idea it was just to allow paper to represent nothing in the sale and purchase of goods and services. And Hollywood in 1939 thought that satire was so good that they created a movie based on it called The Wizard of Oz. And every character inside The Wizard of Oz was based on certain things in the government. The munchkins, the people we eat represent, the lollipop kill, right? They represented the small guy, the guy who really wasn't big enough to take on anything. He was just the Wicked Witch of the East represented something. But really, the point of all of this was you get to the end of the movie, and the travelers have traveled the Yellow Brick Road, they fought through all of the struggles. They get to the magical city of Oz, where everybody's going to get what they want, and they find out that behind the curtain there's nothing but a man with smoke and mirrors. Nothing. Then you see Toto running over there, he's going to pull the curtain back, and you're going to see there's this guy back there dancing a jig, telling you that I am the great and powerful Oz. So this idea was that this gold, Oz, which is the abbreviation for 1 ounce of gold, right? That was E. So fighting to make more money. I've got to get a progressively nicer job so that I can have a progressively nicer car, a progressively nicer house, progressively nicer friends. You guys were good friends while I was broke, but now that I'm not broke, you're not good friends anymore, so I've got these better friends, and you continue your whole life with this lens of gold, this lens of money, this lens of possession, this lens of what's the value of it? Because when you get to the end of life and it pulls back the curtain, you're going to see that there's nothing behind the curtain but a man with smoking mirrors. But if we can figure out how to be people who live life through the lens of the cross, if we can figure out how to be people who live life through the lens of the gospel, the good news that God in heaven saw a problem on earth, sent his own son to die a death that was yours, to pay a price that you couldn't pay, to offer you a hope and a future that you could never attain on your own. Now you start to see life through a standard that's not going to burn up at the end. You're going to see life through a standard that matters. And that's what Peter is trying to do here. So we'll go through. We're going to take this part a little bit. But first, before we do that, I want you to see the very first few words in verse 6 say, in this you rejoice. Well, in what? What are we rejoicing in? So we're going to go back. If you missed last week, I'm going to go back and I'm going to read to you. Check back up to 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 3. It says, blessed be the God, Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. According to his great mercy, he has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance that is imperishable, undefiled, unfading, kept in heaven for you, who by God's power are being guarded through faith for salvation, ready to be revealed in the last times. And in that, you rejoice. You rejoice in the fact that God caused you to be born again to a living hope. There was nothing you could have done to do that. He looked in and saw you with eyes of love and said, I want you to be my own. And when I make you my own, I'm going to give you an inheritance that's unfading, undefiled, it's imperishable, and I'm going to keep it for you right here in heaven, which means no one ever will be able to take that from you. It is yours forever. So in that, you rejoice. And so, keeping that as our lens, in that we rejoice, we're going to look at four reasons why how we can endure suffering. So we're going to just kind of run through these verses now. We'll go through each verse by itself. So, here we go. Verse 6 says, in this you rejoice, though now, for a little while, if necessary, you have been grieved by various trials. So the first thing that Peter is doing is he is pointing us through Jesus to point beyond our suffering, beyond our trials. He's saying, we're going to rejoice, even though now, for a little while, you're plagued by various trials. So, first thing I thought as I was reading it is, it says, if necessary. So why is it necessary that I have to go through? Why is it necessary that I have to lose a loved one? Why is it necessary that I went to college and I have the qualifications to get this job, but I can't seem to get this job, I keep getting this job, or I can't find a job at all, or I find myself addicted to a substance that I just can't get free from, or I find myself, I just find myself alone, no one's ever going to love me. So why is it necessary that I have to go through those things? And we're going to get to that in a minute. So if necessary, he points us, the idea is he points us to a time beyond when our trials end. And so there's a little phrase that I grew up hearing about trials, struggles, suffering. There's three kind of places you find yourself in. You either find yourself in the middle of the struggle, you find yourself coming out of the struggle, or you find the struggle coming directly for you. So what he is doing through the power of the cross is saying there's a time beyond this. And if it's necessary, which means if it's necessary, there has to be a point to it. So I'm just going to hold on to the fact that Christ accomplished all this for me on the cross. Our trials, all of this life, are temporary. Everything in this life is temporary. If you don't believe that, maybe it's possible that you haven't graduated from high school. Because for me, you start building these friendships and you realize these are going to be my friends forever. This guy is going to be my best friend, and we're going to be 70 years old. We're going to be sitting on a porch. We're going to sit coffee. We're going to be best friends forever. And then we graduate from high school. What about the guy who was a really big time high school athlete? And I am going to play football forever. I'm going to make a living doing that. I'm going to play volleyball. I'm going to do whatever. That was a plan. But we're going to do that. But then you graduate from high school, and what happens? All your friends go to a different college, and you go to college over here. Maybe if you were a big-time athlete, you get over here, and you realize I was a big fish in a small pond, and maybe playing football isn't in the cards for me. I'm only 5'7", and I'm not very strong, so maybe the flag football team that was co-ed that I played on in high school didn't really prepare me for the rest of my life as a football player. And so you see, that's one of the first times that you see that the things in this life are temporary. And then if you moved on, maybe you joined the military, or you graduated from college, or you just started working. And those are going to be the people that are going to be your best friends forever. Then maybe God calls you to pick up all your stuff and leave Texas. Your mom and your dad are your friends, and tells you to move 1,700 miles away to New York. And now you find yourself here with your wife's family, and that's good. At least I got somebody. But what about all my friends? And then you realize the temporary nature of everything, right? So we fix our eyes on the cross, which is the only thing that isn't temporary. Look at number two. We're going to read verse 7. We're going to find out why it is necessary that you are grieved by various trials, so that the tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold that perishes though it is tested by fire, may be found to result in the praise and honor and glory of Christ. And so the reason that you walk through these difficult times is so that the tested genuineness of your faith results in praise, honor, and glory for Christ. So when you walk through this time, maybe you lose somebody that you love. And it's hard. Why do I have to go through this? And you got one of two options. The first option is, you know what? I'm just going to get over this. Maybe you had this goal in life that you were going to achieve. This kind of did a Superman pose. Realized how ridiculous that would be. Maybe you had this goal in life you were going to achieve. You were going to be this, and as you were walking through it, it didn't seem to be everything you thought it was going to be, and maybe you gave up. Or you kind of lose your job. Now you've got half the income. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to knuckle down. Dang it, I shouldn't have bought my knuckle earlier. We're going to knuckle down. We're going to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. We are going to work harder and harder. We're going to make up for that money. We're going to do this and that. And I can take this on. And then the tested genuineness of your faith becomes about me. Because this is what I can do. And so at the end of it, whether it succeeds or fails, the honor and the praise and the glory goes to me. But the bad news is that there's something else going to come along. And how many times are you going to be able to muster up the strength to overcome the challenges in your life? When I stand here reading to you from a Bible that says that there is a God who stands to put those things back together. So he cranks up the heat in your life, not because he doesn't love you, not because he's mad at you. He cranks that heat up because he loves you, and he wants everything inside of you that is from this planet to rise to the top so that he can scoop that out. And every single time he cranks that heat up and those things rise to the top, you end up looking a little bit more like Jesus every time. And so why is it necessary that you're grieved by various trials? Because God has an end result for you, and that end result is not so result that he's got for you is that he gets the honor and the praise and the glory. That's why he sent Jesus from heaven perfect to earth not perfect, to die a death that belonged to you, to accomplish for you what you could not. You see in James chapter 1, this idea of kind of the why it's necessary. It says, count it all joy, brothers, when you face trials of various kinds, because it's the testing of your faith that develops perseverance. And then, when perseverance has finished its work, you'll be mature and complete, not lacking in anything. And so what's the point of these temporary trials that we walk through? To develop perseverance. And when perseverance finishes its work, you'll be mature and complete. So the first question I've got is, when does that happen? When can I be mature and complete? When will perseverance be over? And the bad news is that perseverance doesn't end on this planet. Because our hope is not fixed here on this planet. So perseverance is something that God is going to continue to do. So every single time he cranks up that heat, where do you turn? First I turn to me, and then I realize I failed, and I turn to him. And then the next time he cranks that heat up, and I turn to me, but not quite as long as last time, because I realize that I failed me, and I turn to him. To the point where you get to the point where I'd love to do this myself, but he's my answer. I'd love to do this myself, but he's the answer. So you consider it all joy when you face trials of many kinds. And that's the next thing, is that number three, is that he attaches joy with suffering. He attaches joy with suffering. You're going to see something very interesting here as you read through verse 8. Up in verse 3, he says he has caused us, and Peter includes himself in to what he's writing. But once you get down to verse 8, he's no longer including himself. And he says, so it says right here, though you have not seen him, you love him. And though you do not now see him, you believe in him and you rejoice with joy. So if I'm walking through these trials, I'm walking through the death of someone who was the most precious person to me. I'm walking through the loss of my dream job. I'm walking through watching my child walk through sickness that no one should ever have to watch their child walk through. I'm walking through the worst of times, and I'm supposed to rejoice with joy. So that made me ask, what in the world is joy? What in the world is joy? See, Peter, the reason he disconnects himself from what he was writing and he talks about you is because Peter lived with Jesus. He walked with Jesus. He saw Jesus alive. He saw Jesus die. He saw Jesus buried. He saw the empty tomb, and then he saw him alive again. And so Peter has great cause to believe. But you, though you have not seen him, you love him. And though you do not now see him, you believe in him. And so this idea that joy is something larger than my idea, because my idea of joy is I always want to attach happiness with it. I worked with teenagers for a long time. And working with them, he asked them, what is joy? But joy is, I'm so happy that I got this new video game, or I'm so happy that I got this job so that now I can put gas in the car and go here. I'm so happy when we end up attaching happiness to joy, which really seems to make God really sadistic, makes God really weird, because then he would say, so that you are happy with large happiness. Or James writes, consider it all sorts of happiness when you go through trials of various kinds. So obviously the word joy was not the same as happiness. Okay, so I'm supposed to be joyful. And it doesn't mean I have to be happy. How in the world am I supposed to be happy? Maybe happiness is not something we're supposed to chase after. So what he does here is see as you continue to read there in verse 8. Rejoice with joy that is inexpressible and filled with glory. And there are people that will tell you that God has great things for you. He wants you to have a better quality of life. He wants you to have that big house, that nice car, all that money. But what Peter would tell you here is that that's not what God's aim for you is. The blessing that he's talking about is not stuff. The blessing that he's talking about is his presence. You see, the tested genuineness of your faith would result in honor, praise, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ. And now he tells you down here that you rejoice with joy that is inexpressible, filled with glory. And so my life is being tested to show honor and glory for him. And now somehow at the end of it all, I get some sort of glory too, which points us back up to the top where we're supposed to keep our eyes fixed, because we have this inheritance. It's imperishable. It's unfading. It's unending. And it's kept for us in heaven. You see, when you step into the family of God, when this God who chooses you as his own and draws you into his family, he sets you there as an heir with Christ. And so God sits on the throne as king, and his son sits there as his heir. And now you get to sit in heaven with all of the rights and privileges that come with an heir to the throne. Will you ever sit on the throne? Absolutely not. But if you look over in England, that's kind of the earthly picture of royal family, right? The queen has a son. The son has two sons. One of those sons will sit on the throne one day, and the other will not. But he gets to experience all of the rights and privileges that come with being the royal family. So he gets royal family training, and he gets royal family housing, and he has money that he'll never be able to burn through. That's what you have. The blessing that you get from the tested genuineness of your faith is a reward of his presence in your life, which is way better than anything that you could ever get on your own. The number four, I kind of just said it already. We receive glory as Christ gets glory. You see over in Romans chapter 8, verse 18, it says, Paul's writing, he says, I don't consider that the sufferings of this world, this present time, they're not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed. I don't understand that on face value as I read that. You're telling me that what I'm going through right now isn't worth my time and energy? You're telling me that I shouldn't think about how difficult what I'm walking through is right now? And that's not what he's telling me. What he's saying is, compared to the glory that's set aside for you, it's almost nothing. You see, we live on planet Earth for a fixed number of years. The average male lives 70 years. I don't know if that's changed, but there's a church member here who's 100 years old. He spends his time with his wife on Earth at the retirement home. And so you would say that in his 100 years, probably about half the time he's spent kind of struggling. You know, I went through this for 2 years, and I got better, and then I went 6 months and went through this. And you look and say, I spent half my life struggling. And when you look at the struggle on the timeline here on Earth, and it's really, really depressing. It's really sad. Because I spent more time working through the struggle than I did celebrating the rewards of the struggle. But there's this idea that Paul is talking about here, where he realizes that in the scheme of his lifetime, yeah, I've walked through a lot. And he, in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, he tells you, two times I was beaten 40 lashes less one. I was shipwrecked for a night and a day floating at sea. I've been chased out of town with rocks being thrown at me. that the struggle of this present time is not worth comparing to the glory that is to be revealed. And so he's got this idea that his fixed time on earth is just a little snapshot when it comes to eternity. You see, before there was me, there was God. And after there is me, there is God. And so on the timeline of earth, yeah, you had 70 years and you spent 35 of it struggling. But on the timeline of eternity, you had about 5 seconds. And you spent about 2.5 seconds struggling. So this idea that struggling is just going to be who I am forever is true if you keep your eyes fixed on this planet. If you fix your eyes on how you can get around it. You see, when we go through the mess, what are we most likely to do? Most likely to numb ourselves. You know what? I'm over today. I can't handle it. And so I'm going to turn to the bottle. I'm going to turn to the pill bottle. I'm going to turn to something. And I'll just give it a try again tomorrow. But you wake up tomorrow and you're like, it's all still there. Or I'm just going to work harder. I'm going to do more. I'm going to get 3 jobs. I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that now. It all kind of terminates on me. So struggling and trials are good. They're intended. And they're designed to make you look more like Jesus. That's God's end for you. He wants you to reflect the image of the Son. And he can't do that when you're filled up with the things of this planet. You cannot reflect the image of Jesus when you're filled up with you. So what do we need to do? Somehow, some way, we have to come to the realization that this thing cannot start and end with me. I've been warring to make my marriage. I've been warring to make my relationships work. I've been fighting with all I've got to figure out how to be happy after losing that loved one. And I just can't do it anymore. And so you let go. And you rest in the fact that God chose you as his own. Gave you an inheritance that can't be taken away. So we wrap our time up like this. We just kind of close our eyes, bow our head. It's not supposed to be a weird thing. It's just supposed to give you the opportunity to just be alone with God and just think about the things that he has just spoken to your heart. And usually what I do is I just ask questions and then we just kind of pray about those questions. So the first thing that I would wonder this morning is if there's anybody in the room that's just walking through the mess right now. Is there anybody who would be willing to raise their hand and say that life is just coming at me from all directions and I have been fighting with everything inside of me to fix it? Whether it's a relationship, whether it's an illness of a family member, whether it's the loss of someone that you love, whether it's a struggle with addiction. Is there anybody in the room that would be willing to raise their hand and say that's me this morning? Anybody would say, I'm just depressed. And I just can't figure out how to find joy in anything. Things that should give me joy. I just feel numb. I'll tell you, you guys have your head bowed and eyes closed, but right now I kind of walk through that. That's kind of me. See, my birthday was a couple weeks ago, and I had just spent the Christmas season with my mom, my dad, my brother, his family, all my friends, and to celebrate my birth, I got on an airplane in the opposite direction. You see, I've been a part of this, what God is doing here. I'm so thrilled that he has me. so this thing that's growing, that God is blessing and doing things in, if I could just be honest with you, I mean, you can be mad at me, I don't care. I don't care what people think. But this thing that should bring me great joy, I come to every day, and sometimes I just feel numb. I want you guys to fall in love with Jesus with everything that I have inside of me. And that's why I show up. And the thing that I should wake up in the morning and think, I can't wait to be a part of what God is doing. I'm walking through a time where I just feel so alone. So this picture that God is painting for me right now is that even if you've never had friends like you had before, am I alone? And I know the church answer is yes. And if I ask you right now, if watching your daughter and your wife in a hospital is what you're supposed to experience for the rest of your life, is God enough? Knowing that you just lost God, it just seems like God took away a family member that you love. Is He enough to fill up that emptiness? And the church answer to that is yes. Is coming to the end of addiction, where I just try to fill my life up with all of this other stuff. If coming to the end of just being a workaholic and just trying to fill up my soul with accomplishing things on this planet, I just can't do that anymore. And so God stands there saying, am I enough? You just lost your granddaughter or your daughter, or your son, or your grandpa. And God can stand there and say, I can relate. I gave up my son for you. So I know the pain that you're feeling. But I did it for a purpose. I did it to be enough. And so this morning, I'm just gonna pray the prayer that I've tried to pray for myself. It's a prayer that you can echo. Substitute in your thing. And you can try to pray this every day. Just wake up and I say, God, I just feel so empty. I feel so numb and I feel so alone. And I know in my head that you are enough. So it's weird to say this, God, but thank you for turning up this temperature in my life so that you can raise all of that impurity off me. And scoop that away, God, because what I want at the end of it all is that I reflect Jesus so that you get the honor and the praise and the glory. It's not comfortable, and God, I'm going to tell you that I am not happy with this. So one, I'm glad that you're big enough to take it when I tell you I'm not happy. But two, God, I need you to teach me to approach every day with the joy that's set before me, knowing that I get to spend forever with you. It's in Jesus' name, God, I pray that. With your heads bowed and your eyes still closed, I have one more question. I wonder if there's anyone in the room that would be honest enough to say, there is no joy of the glory set before me. You see, I have to live this life like I am the solution, because I don't have this relationship with God. I am not in His family. And I'm telling you this morning that He stands with an open invitation. no hoops to jump through, no tricks you have to do. An invitation for you to confess with your mouth that He is the Lord. Believe in your heart that God raised Him from the dead. That this hope, this joy, and this glory can be yours. So I'm going to count to three, and I wonder if anybody will be so bold as to raise their hand and say, I've never, ever stepped into the family of God, and I'm ready to do that right now. I am tired of trying to put me back together, and I'm ready to follow Him with all that I am. 1, 2, 3. You raise your hand this morning. There's no works that you have to do, no being better, no giving up your vices. He wants you to do those things, but that's not what's going to make you right with Him. And so it just kind of starts out with this prayer of confession and the acknowledgement that He is the leader of your life. And we'll talk about how you can figure out how to walk in that. So you just pray this: God, I'm so empty. I'm so tired of trying to put me back together. And so God, I'm gonna place my faith in You. It says if I confess with my mouth that Jesus is Lord, if I confess with my life that Jesus is the leader, I'm no longer in charge. It's no longer up to me to pull myself up by my bootstraps, but it is up to Him to put me together, and I say yes to that. Because I believe that Your power raised Him. So God, I'm not sure what it means, and I'm not sure what it looks like, but I'm ready for You to make me whole. And if you just prayed that prayer this morning, I want you to come and talk to me and Pastor Jay. We have a little book that we want to send home with you. This is a few chapters. Easy reading. You can read it in an hour if you sat down all at one time. And just talk to you about some things that you need to start doing to grow in that decision that you just made. And then after church today, we've got these four small groups for you to check out, be a part of. We believe that the best way to grow is to do it in the context of God-first relationships. And that's what our small groups are designed to do, is to put you in the middle of people's lives so that you can be honest and open and you can begin to walk forward. See, the beginning of this section in chapter 3 says, blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. And then it ends with the praise and honor and glory of God. And there's a church word for that called doxology, and it's just worship. So this section about us living as the people of God begins with worship and it ends with worship. So we're going to wrap up our time this morning by going back into musical worship. We're going to sing out this idea that God holds every single moment. And when the seas start to get crazy in our life, He is the God who calms them and leads us into still waters. So this confession that we believe that He is our healer and